his side and grew quiet, or told one of his long-winded fables. "The Ashantis have been angry with us for years," Fifi said. "Ever since the time they found out we traded other Ashantis brought to us by some northerners Badu found. Badu told me then that we trade with the ones who pay more. It is the same thing I told the Ashantis when they found out. The same thing I told you. Ashanti anger is to be expected, Kwee. And you are right that it is not to be underestimated. But trust me, they are wise where we are cunning. They will forgive." Fifi stopped talking, and Kwee watched as his uncle's youngest daughter, a girl of only two, played in the yard. After a while, a house girl came by with a snack of groundnuts and bananas. She approached Fifi first, but he stopped her. With a level voice and leveled gaze, he said, "You must serve my son first." The woman did as she was told, bowing before Kwee, and reaching out with her right hand. After they had both received their fill, the girl left while Kwee watched the measured sway of her ample hips. "Why do you always say that?" Kwee asked, once he was sure she had gone.
"Why do I say what?"
"That I'm your son." Kwee looked down, spoke so softly that he hoped the ground would swallow his sound. "You never claimed me before." Fifi split the shell of a groundnut with his teeth, separating it from the nut itself and spitting it onto the ground before them. He looked toward the thin dirt road that led away from his compound and toward the village square. He looked as though he were expecting someone. "You are in England too long, Kwee. Maybe you have forgotten that here, mothers, sisters, and their sons are most important. If you are chief, your sister's son is your successor because your sister was born of your mother, but your wife was not. Your sister's son is more important to you than even your own son. But Kwee, your mother is not my sister. She is not the daughter of my mother. And when she married a white man from the castle, I began to lose her. And because my mother had always hated her, I began to hate her too. And this hate was good, at first. It made me work harder. I would think about her and all of the white people in the castle, and I would say, 'My people here in this village, we will be stronger than the white men. We will be richer too.' And when Badu became too greedy and too fat to fight, I began to fight for him. And even then, I hated your mother and your father. And I hated my own mother, and I hated my own father, too, for the kind of people I knew that they were. I suppose I even began to hate myself. The last time your mother came to this village, I was 15 years old. It was for my father's funeral, and after Ethia had gone, Baba told me that because she was not truly my sister, I owed her nothing. And for many years I believed that. But I am an old man now, wiser, but weaker. In my youth, no man could have touched me with his machete. But now—" Fifi's voice trailed off as he gestured to his wound. He cleared his throat and continued. "Soon, all that I have helped to build in this village will no longer belong to me. I have sons, but I have no sisters. And so all that I have helped to build will blow away like dust in a breeze. I am the one who told your governor to give you this job, Kwee, because you are the person I am supposed to leave all of this to. I loved Ethia as a sister once. So even though you are not of my mother, you are the closest thing to a firstborn nephew that I have. I will give you all that I have. I will make up for my mother's wrongdoings. Tomorrow night, you will marry Nanaya, so that even if the Ashanti king and all of his men come knocking on my door, they cannot deny you. They cannot kill you or anyone in this village, because it is now your village as it was once your mother's. I will make sure you become a very powerful man, so that even after the white men have all gone from this Gold Coast, and believe me, they will go, you will still matter long after the castle walls have crumbled. Fifi began to pack a pipe. He blew out of it until white smoke formed little roofs above the pipe's bowl. The rainy season was coming, and soon the air would start to thicken, and the people of the Gold Coast would have to relearn how to move in a climate that was always hot and wet, as though it intended to cook its inhabitants for dinner. This was how they lived there, in the bush. Eat, or be eaten. Capture, or be captured. Marry for protection. Quay would never go to Cujo's village. He would not be weak. He was in the business of slavery, and sacrifices had to be made.
Ness.
There was no drinking gourd, no spiritual soothing enough to mend the broken spirit. Even the Northern Star was a hoax. Every day, Ness picked cotton under the punishing eye of the southern sun. She had been at Thomas Allen Stockham's Alabama plantation for 3 months. 2 weeks before, she was in Mississippi. A year before that, she was in a place she would only ever describe as hell. Though she had tried, Ness couldn't remember how old she was. Her best guess was 25. But each year since the one when she was plucked from her mother's arms had felt like 10 years. Ness's mother, Essie, had been a solemn, solid woman who was never known to tell a happy story. Even Ness's bedtime stories had been ones about what Essie used to call the big boat. Ness would fall asleep to the images of men being thrown into the Atlantic Ocean like anchors attached to nothing. No land, no people, no worth. In the big boat, Essie said, they were stacked 10 high. And when a man died on top of you, his weight would press the pile down like cooks pressing garlic. Ness's mother, called Frowny by the other slaves because she never smiled, used to tell the story of how she'd been cursed by a little dove long, long ago, cursed and sisterless, she would mutter as she swept, left without her mother's stone. When they sold Ness in 1796, Essie's lips had stood in that same thin line. Ness could remember reaching out for her mother, flailing her arms and kicking her legs, fighting against the body of the man who'd come to take her away. And still Essie's lips had not moved. Her hands had not reached out. She stood there, solid and strong, the same as Ness had always known her to be. And though Ness had met warm slaves on other plantations, black people who smiled and hugged and told nice stories, she would always miss the gray rock of her mother's heart. She would always associate real love with a hardness of spirit. Thomas Allen Stockham was a good master, if such a thing existed. He gave them 5-minute breaks for every 3 hours, and the field slaves were allowed onto the porch to receive 1 mason jar full of water from the house slaves. This day, in late June, Ness waited in line for water beside Tim Tam. He was a gift to the Stockham family from their neighbors, the Whitmans, and Tom Allen often liked to say that Tim Tam was the best gift he'd ever received. Better even than the gray-tailed cat his brother had given him for his 5th birthday, or the red wagon he'd received for his 2nd.
How your day been?
Tim Tam asked.
Ness turned toward him just slightly. Ain't all days the same?
Tim Tam laughed, a sound that rumbled like thunder built from the cloud of his gut and expelled through the sky of his mouth.
I suppose you're right, he said.
Ness was not certain she would ever get used to hearing English spill out of the lips of black people. In Mississippi, Essie had spoken to her in Cree until their master caught her. He'd given Essie 5 lashes for every Cree word Ness spoke, and when Ness, seeing her battered mother, had become too scared to speak, he gave Essie 5 lashes for each minute of Ness's silence. Before the lashes, her mother had called her Mame, after her own mother, but the master had whipped Essie for that too, whipped her until she cried out,
My goodness!
The words escaping her without thought, no doubt picked up from the cook, who used to say it to punctuate every sentence. And because those had been the only English words to escape Essie's mouth without her struggling to find them, she believed that what she was saying must have been something divine, like the gift of her daughter. And so that goodness had turned into, simply, Ness.
Where you coming from? Tim Tam asked.
He chewed the chaffy end of a wheat stalk and spit.
You ask too many questions, Ness said.
She turned away. It was her turn to receive water from Margaret, the head house slave. But the woman poured only enough to fill a quarter of the glass.
We ain't got enough today, she said.
But Ness could see that the buckets of water on the porch behind her were enough to last a week. Margaret looked at Ness, but Ness got the feeling that she was really looking through her, or rather, that she was looking 5 minutes into Ness's past, trying to discern whether or not the conversation Ness had just had with Tim Tam meant that the man was interested in her. Tim Tam cleared his throat.
Now, Margaret, he said, that ain't no kind of way to treat somebody.
Margaret glared at him and plunged her ladle into the bucket, but Ness didn't accept the offering. She walked away, leaving the two people to stew. While there may have been a piece of paper declaring that she belonged to Tom Allen Stockham, there was no such paper shackling her to the whims of her fellow slaves.
"You ain't got to be so hard on him,"
a woman said once Ness resumed her position in the field. The woman seemed older, mid to late 30s, but her back hunched even when she stood up straight.
You new here, so you don't know.
Tim Tam done lost his woman long while ago, and he been taking care of little Pinky by hisself ever since. Ness looked at the woman. She tried to smile, but she had been born during the years of Essie's unsmiling, and she had never learned how to do it quite right. The corners of her lips always seemed to twitch upward, unwillingly, then fall within milliseconds, as though attached to that sadness that had once anchored her own mother's heart.
"Ain't we all done lost someone?" Ness asked.
Ness was too pretty to be a field nigger. That's what Tom Allen said to her the day he'd taken her back to his plantation. He'd bought her on good faith from a friend of his in Jackson, Mississippi, who said she was one of the best field hands he'd ever seen, but to make quite sure to only use her in the field. Seeing her, light-skinned with kinked hair that raced down her back in search of her round shelf of buttocks, Tom Allen thought his friend must have made some kind of mistake. He pulled out the little outfit he liked for his house niggers to wear, a white button-down with a boat neckline and capped sleeves, a long black skirt attached to a little black apron. He'd had Margaret take Ness into the back room so that she could change into it, and Ness had done what she was told. Margaret, seeing Ness all done up, clutched her hand to her heart and told Ness to wait there. Ness had to press her ear to the wall to hear what Margaret said.
"She ain't fit for the house," Margaret told Tom Allen. "Well, let me see her, Margaret. I'm sure I can decide for myself whether or not somebody's fit to work in my own house. Now, can't I?
Yes, sir, Margaret said. I reckon you is, but it ain't something you gon' want to see, is what I'm saying.
Tom Allen laughed. His wife, Susan, came into the room and asked what all the fuss was about.
Why, Margaret's got our new nigger locked up in the back and won't let us see her. Stop this nonsense now and go fetch her here.
If Susan was like any of the other master's wives, she must have known that her husband's bringing a new nigger into the house meant she had better pay attention. In this and every other southern county, men's eyes and other body parts had been known to wander.
Yes, Margaret. Bring the girl so we can see. Don't be silly about it.
Margaret shrugged her shoulders and went back to the room, and Ness pulled her ear from the wall.
Well, you best come out, was all Margaret said.
And so Ness did. She walked out to her audience of two, her shoulders bared, as well as the bottom halves of her calves, and when Susan Stockham saw her, she fainted outright. It was all Tom Allen could do to catch his wife while shouting at Margaret to go change Ness at once. Margaret rushed her into the back room and left in search of field clothes, and Ness stood in the center of that room, running her hands along her body, reveling in her ugly nakedness. She knew it was the intricate scars on her bare shoulders that had alarmed them all. But the scars weren't just there. No, her scarred skin was like another body in and of itself, shaped like a man hugging her from behind with his arms hanging around her neck. They went up from her breasts, rounded the hills of her shoulders, and traveled the full, proud length of her back. They licked the top of her buttocks before trailing away into nothing. Ness's skin was no longer skin, really. More like the ghost of her past made seeable. Physical. She didn't mind the reminder. Margaret came back in the room with a headscarf, a brown top that covered the shoulders, a red skirt that went all the way to the floor. She watched Ness put them on.
It's a shame, really. For a second, I thought you might have been prettier than me.
She clucked her tongue twice and left the room. And so Ness worked in the field. It was not new to her. In hell, she'd worked the land, too. In hell, the sun scorched cotton so hot it almost burned the palms of your hands to touch it. Holding those small white puffs almost felt like holding fire. But God forbid you let one drop. The devil was always watching. Hell was where she had learned to be a good field hand, and the skill had carried her all the way to Tuscumbia. It was her second month at the Stockham plantation. She lived in one of the women's cabins, but she had made no friends. Everyone knew her as the woman who had snubbed Tim Tam, and the ladies, angry when they thought that she was the object of his desire, and even angrier when they realized she didn't want to be that object, treated her as though she were little more than a strong wind, an annoyance that you could still push through. In the mornings, Ness prepared her pail to take out to the field with her. Cornmeal cakes, a bit of salt pork, and, if she was lucky, some greens. In hell, she had learned to eat standing up, picking cotton with her right hand, shoveling food in with her left. It wasn't something she was required to do here at Tom Allen's, work while eating, but she didn't know any other way.
"Look like she thinks she better than us," one woman called, just loudly enough so Ness could hear.
"Tom Allen sure gon' think so," another said.
"Nuh-uh. Tom Allen ain't paid her no mind since she got kicked out the big house," the first one said.
Ness had learned how to tune the voices out. She tried to remember the tree that Essie used to speak to her. Tried to still her mind until all that was left was the thin,
stern line of her mother's lips. Lips that used to usher out words of love in a tongue that Ness could no longer quite grasp. Phrases and words would come to her, mismatched or lopsided, wrong. She worked all day like this, listening to the sounds of the South, the insistent buzz of mosquitoes, that screech of cicadas, the hum of slave gossip. At night she would return to her quarters, beat out her pallet until dust billowed from it, wrapping around her like a hug. She would set it back down again and wait for a sleep that rarely came, trying her best to still the harrowing images that danced behind her closed eyelids. It was on a night like this, just when she had snapped her pallet into the air, that the pounding started. Fists beating against the door of the women's cabin in a steady, urgent rhythm.
"Please," a voice called. "Please help us."
A woman named Mavis opened the door. Tim Tam stood there cradling his daughter Pinky in his arms. He pushed into the room, his voice choked, though there were no tears in his eyes.
"I think she got what her mama had," he said.
The woman cleared a spot for the girl, and Tim Tam set her down before he started to pace.
"Oh, Lord! Oh, Lord! Oh, Lord!" he cried.
"You best go fetch Tom Allen so we can get the doctor," Ruthie said.
"Doctor ain't helped last time," Tim Tam said.
Ness stood behind a row of women, their shoulders squared as if headed into battle. She pushed her way through to the center to catch a glimpse of the child. Pinky was small and sharp-edged, as though her body were built from sticks with no bend to them. Her hair was tied up in two big puffs. The whole time the women were watching her, she made no noise save for a quick intake of breath.
"Ain't nothing wrong with her," Ness said.
Suddenly, Tim Tam stopped his pacing as everyone turned to stare at Ness.
"You ain't been round here long," Tim Tam said. "Pinky ain't spoke a word since her mama died, and now she can't stop with these hiccups."
"Ain't nothing but hiccups," Ness said. "Those ain't killed anyone yet, far's I know."
She looked around at all the women shaking their heads at her disapprovingly, but she couldn't tell what she had done wrong. Tim Tam pulled her aside.
"These women ain't told you," he whispered,
and Ness shook her head. The women so rarely spoke to her, and she had finally gotten good at tuning out their gossip. Tim Tam cleared his throat and hung his head a little lower.
"See, we know ain't nothing wrong with her but the hiccups, but we've been trying to get her to speak, so—"
His voice trailed off as Ness began to understand that the whole thing had been nothing more than a plot to trick little Pinky into utterance. Ness pulled away from Tim Tam and looked at the small congregation of women carefully, from one to the next, and then the next. She made her way to the center of the room, where Pinky lay on the pallet, her eyes staring up at the ceiling. The girl turned her eyes toward Ness and hiccuped once more. Ness addressed the room.
"Lord, I don't know what kind of foolishness I done walked into at this here plantation, but you all need to leave this girl alone. Maybe she don't want to speak 'cause she know just how crazy it make you. Or maybe she ain't got nothing to say yet. But I reckon she ain't gonna start tonight just because y'all making like you actors in a traveling show."
The women wrung their hands and shifted their feet, and Tim Tam's head sunk a little lower. Ness walked back to her pallet, finished beating the dust out, and lay down. Tim Tam walked over to Pinky.
"Well, let's go," he said, reaching for the girl. But she pulled away. "I said let's go," he repeated, shame coloring his voice gray.
But the girl snatched herself away again. She went over to where Ness lay, her eyes shut tightly as she begged sleep to come quick. Pinky's hand brushed Ness's shoulder, and she opened her eyes to see the girl staring at her, round moon eyes imploring. And because Ness understood loss, and because she understood motherlessness, and wanting, and even silence. She reached for the girl's hand and pulled her down onto the bed.
"You go on ahead," she said to Tim Tam. Pinky's head already nestled between the soft cushions of her breasts. "I got her tonight."
From that day forward, Pinky could not be separated from Ness. She had even moved from the other women's cabin into Ness's. She slept with Ness, ate with Ness, took walks with Ness, and cooked with Ness. Still, she didn't speak, and Ness never asked her to, knowing full well that Pinky would speak when she had something to say, laugh when something was truly funny. For her part, Ness, who had not known how much she missed company, took comfort in the girl's quiet presence. Pinky was the water girl. On any given day she would make as many as 40 trips to the small creek on the edge of the Stockhams' plantation. She carried a plank of wood across her back, arms folded over it from behind so that she looked like a man holding a cross, and on each end of the plank hung two silver pails. Once she had reached the creek, Pinky would fill those pails, bring them back to the main house, and then empty them into the large water buckets that lived on the Stockham porch. She would fill the basins in the house so that the Stockham children would have fresh water for their afternoon baths. She would water the flowers that sat on Susan Stockham's dressing table. From there, she went to the kitchen to give two pailfuls to Margaret for the day's cooking. She walked the same worn path every day, down to the creek, back up to the house. By the end of the day, her arms would throb so hard Ness could feel her heart beat in them when the girl crawled into bed with Ness at night, and the woman hugged her close. The hiccups had not stopped, continuing since the day Tim Tam had brought her into Ness's cabin, hoping to scare the child into speaking. Everyone pitched in with a remedy.
"Stand the girl upside down. Tell her hold her breath and swallow. Cross two straws on top of her head."
The last remedy, put forth by a woman named Harriet, was the one that seemed to work. Pinky made 34 trips to the creek without a single hiccup. Ness was on the porch getting her fill of water on Pinky's 35th trip back. The two red-headed Stockham children were out and about that day, the boy named Tom Jr. and the girl, Mary. They were running up the stairs just as Pinky rounded the corner, and Tom Jr. knocked the plank so that one of the pails went flying into the air, water raining down on everyone on the porch. Mary started to cry.
"My dress is all wet," she said.
Margaret, who had just finished ladling out water for one of the other slaves, set the ladle down.
"Hush now, Miss Mary."
Tom Jr., who had never been much for gallantry, decided to try it just then for his sister's sake.
"Well,
apologize to Mary," he said to Pinky. The two were the same age, though Pinky was about a foot taller. Pinky opened her mouth, but no words came out.
"She's sorry," Ness said quickly.
"I wasn't talking to you," Tom Jr. said.
Mary had stopped crying and was staring at Pinky intently.
"Tom, you know she don't talk," Mary said. "It's all right, Pinky."
"She'll talk if I tell her to talk," Tom Jr. said, shoving his sister.
"Apologize to Mary," he repeated.
The sun was high and hot that day. Indeed, Ness could see that the two wet drops on Mary's dress had already dried. Pinky, eyes welling with tears, opened her mouth again, and a wave of hiccups came out, frantic and loud. Tom Jr. shook his head. He went into the house while everyone watched and returned with the Stockham cane. It was twice his length, made of a dull birchwood. It wasn't thick, but it was so heavy that Tom Jr. could hardly hold it with both of his hands, let alone the one it would take to snap it back.
"Speak, nigger," Tom Jr. said, and Margaret, who had long since stopped her ladling, ran into the house crying.
Ooh, Tom Jr., I'm going to find your daddy.
Pinky was sobbing and hiccuping all at once, the hiccups blocking whatever speech she might have given. Tom Jr. lifted the cane in his right hand with great effort and tried to snap it over his shoulder. But Ness, who was standing behind him, caught the tip of it in her hand. It tore through her palms as she tugged so hard that Tom Jr. fell to the ground. She dragged him half an inch. Tom Allen appeared on the porch with Margaret, who was breathless and clutching her chest.
"What's this?" he asked.
Tom Jr. started crying.
"She was going to hit me, Daddy," he said.
Margaret tried to speak up.
"Master Tom, you lie. You was..."
Tom Allen raised his hand to stop Margaret's speech and looked at Ness. Maybe he remembered the scars on her shoulders. Remembered how they had kept his wife laid up in bed for the rest of that day and put him off his dinner for a week. Maybe he wondered what a nigger had to do to earn stripes like that. What trouble a nigger like that must be capable of. And there his son was on the ground with dirt on his shorts, and the mute child Pinky crying. Ness was sure that he could see clear as day what had happened. But it was the memory of her scars that made him doubt. A nigger with scars like that, and his son on the ground? There wasn't anything else he could do.
"I'll deal with you soon enough," he said to Ness, and everyone wondered what would happen.
That evening, Ness returned to the women's quarters. She crawled into her bed and closed her eyes, waiting for the images that played every night behind her lids to steal to darkness. Beside her, Pinky began to hiccup.
"Oh, Lord, here she go. Ain't we had enough trouble for one day?" one of the women said. "Can't get no kind of rest when this girl start to hiccup."
Ashamed, Pinky slapped a hand to her mouth as though with it she could erect a wall to block the sound's escape.
"Don't pay them no mind," Ness whispered. "Thinking about it only make it worse."
She didn't know if she was speaking to Pinky or to herself. Pinky squeezed her eyes tight as a series of hiccups exploded from her lips.
"Leave her be,"
Ness said to the chorus of groans, and they listened. The events of the day had planted a little dual seed of respect and pity for Ness that they watered with deference of their own. They didn't know what Tom Allen would do. In the night, once they had all finally reached sleep, Pinky rolled over and snuggled into the soft skin of Ness's gut. Ness allowed herself to hold the girl, and she allowed herself to drift off into memory. She is back in hell. She is married to a man they call Sam, but who comes straight from the continent and speaks no English. The master of hell, the devil himself, with red leather skin and a shock of gray hair, prefers his slaves married for reasons of insurance, and because Ness is new to hell, and because no one has claimed her, she is given to calm the new slave, Sam. At first they do not speak to each other. Ness doesn't understand his strange tongue, and she is in awe of him, for he is the most beautiful man that she has ever seen, with skin so dark and creamy that looking at it could very well be the same thing as tasting it. His is the large, muscular body of the African beast, and he refuses to be caged, even with Ness as his welcoming gift. Ness knows that the devil must have paid a great deal of money for him, and therefore expects hard work, but nothing anyone does seems to tame him. On his first day he fights with another slave, spits on the overseer, and is stood on a platform and whipped in front of everyone until the blood on the ground is high enough to bathe a baby. Sam refuses to learn English. Each night, in retribution for his still black tongue, the devil sends him back to their marriage bed with lashes that are reopened as soon as they heal. One night, enraged, Sam destroys the slave quarters, Their room is savaged from wall to wall, and when the devil hears of the destruction, he comes to serve punishment.
I did it, Ness says.
She has spent the night hidden in the left corner of the room, watching this man she's been told is her husband become the animal he's been told that he is. The devil shows no mercy, even though he knows she is lying, even though Sam tries time and again to accept the blame. She is beaten until the whip snaps off her back like puffed taffy, and then she is kicked to the ground. When he leaves, Sam is crying, and Ness is barely conscious. Sam's words come out in a thick and feverish prayer, and Ness can't understand what he's saying. He picks her up gingerly and places her on their pallet. He leaves the house in search of the herbal doctor, 5 miles away, who comes back with the roots and leaves and salves that are smeared into Ness's back as she slips in and out of consciousness. It is the first night that Sam sleeps in the cot with her, and in the morning, when she wakes to fresh pain and festered sores, she finds him sitting at her feet, peering at her face with his big, tired eyes.
"I'm sorry," he says.
They are the first English words he ever speaks to her, to anyone. That week they work side by side in the fields, and the devil, though watchful, does not act against them. In the evenings they return to their bed, but they sleep on opposite sides of it, never touching. Some nights they fear that the devil is watching them as they lie, and those are the nights Sam hugs her body to his, waiting for the metronome of fear that keeps her heart's drumbeat moving quickly to slow. His vocabulary has grown to include her name and his "don't worry" and "quiet." In a month, he will learn love. In a month, once the wounds on both of their backs have hardened to scars, they finally consummate their marriage. He picks her up so easily. She thinks she must have turned into one of the rag dolls she makes for the children to play with. She has never been with a man before, but she imagines that Sam is not a man. For her, he has become something much larger than a man, the Tower of Babel itself, so close to God that it must be toppled. He runs his hands along her scabby back, and she does the same along his. And as they work together, clutching each other, some scars reopen. They are both bleeding now, both bride and bridegroom, in this unholy, holy union. Breath leaves his mouth and enters hers, and they lie together until the roosters crow, until it's time to return to the fields. Ness awoke to Pinky's finger poking her shoulder.
"Ness! Ness!" she spoke.
Ness turned to face the girl, trying to hide her surprise.
"Was you having a bad dream?" she asked.
"No," Ness said. "It looked like you was having a bad dream," the girl said, disappointed because when she was lucky, Ness told her stories.
"It was bad," Ness replied. "But it wasn't no dream."
Morning announced its presence through the rooster's cries, and the women in the slave quarters readied themselves for the day, all the while whispering about Ness's fate. No one had ever seen Tom Allen do a public whipping before, not like the ones they saw or experienced at other plantations. Their master had a river for a stomach, and he hated the sight of blood. No, when Tom Allen wished to punish one of his slaves, he did it in private, somewhere he could close his eyes during, lie down after. But this seemed different. Ness was one of the few slaves that he had ever publicly berated, and she knew that she had embarrassed him, what with his own child lying in the dirt while Pinky stood silent
and unscathed. Ness returned to the same row of field that she was in the day before as everyone stared. It was rumored that Tom Allen's plantation stretched longer than any of the other small plantations in the county, and to finish picking one row of cotton took 2 good days. Without warning, Tim Tam was back behind Ness. He touched her shoulder and she turned.
"They told me Pinky spoke yesterday. I suppose I should say thank you for that, and for the other thing."
Ness looked at him and realized that every time she'd ever seen the man, he was chewing on something, his mouth always working its way around in a circle.
"You ain't got to do nothing," Ness said, bending again.
Tim Tam looked up to check if Tom Allen had arrived on the front porch yet.
"Well, I'm grateful anyway," he said, and he sounded it.
When Ness turned her face up, she saw that he was grinning again, his wide lips pulling back to make way for teeth.
"I can talk to Master Tom for you. He ain't gonna do nothing. I reckon I ain't needed anyone to fight my battles for me before. Don't see why I should start now," Ness said. "Now you go bother somebody else with your gratefulness. Margaret sure seemed like she'd be happy to take it."
Tim Tam's face fell. He nodded at Ness and then returned to his own row. After a few minutes, Tom Allen arrived on the porch and peered out. Everyone looked at Ness from the corners of their eyes. She felt like she sometimes felt at night, in the dark and high mosquito season, when she could feel the presence of something ominous, but could not see the danger itself. She looked at Tom Allen, not more than a speck on the porch from where she stood in the field, and wondered how long it would take for him to act, if he would call her up this very morning, or spend days letting it pass, making her wait. It was waiting that bothered her, that had always bothered her. She and Sam had spent so much time waiting, waiting, waiting. Ness had made Sam wait outside when she was in labor. She gave birth to Kojo during a strange southern winter. An unheard-of snow had blanketed the plantations for a full week, threatening the crops, angering the landowners, making the slaves' hands idle. Ness was holed up in the birthing room the night of the heaviest snowfall, and when the midwife finally arrived and opened the door, a cold wind moved through the room, bringing with it a flurry of snowflakes that melted on the tables and chairs and on Ness's stomach. Throughout the pregnancy, Kojo was the kind of baby who fought the walls of his mother's womb, and the journey out had been no different. Ness had screamed her throat raw, remembering with each push the stories the other slaves told about her own birth. They said Essie hadn't told anyone that Ness was coming. She'd just gone out behind a tree and squatted. They said a strange sound had preceded Ness's newborn wail, and for years after, Ness had listened to them argue about what that sound was. One slave thought it was the flutter of birds' wings, another that it was a spirit, come to help Ness out and then gone with the rumble. Yet another said that the sound had come from Essie herself, that she had gone out to be alone, to have her own private moment of joy with her baby before anyone came to snatch both joy and baby away. The sound, that slave had said, was of Essie laughing, which was why they hadn't recognized it. Ness couldn't imagine anyone laughing through a birth until the midwife finally pulled Kojo out into the world, and her baby boy had wailed, louder than little lungs should have allowed him to wail, and Sam, who had been pacing outside in the snow, thanked his ancestors in Yoruba and waited for the chance to hold him. Then, Ness understood. Following the birth of their son, Sam had come to be all that the devil had wanted him to be,
tame, a good, hard worker who rarely fought or caused trouble. He would remember the way the devil had beaten Ness for his folly. And when he held Kojo, called Joe, for the first time, he'd promised himself that no harm would come to the boy on his account. Then Ness found Aku and told Sam that he would be able to keep that promise. Ness had been sitting in the back of the church on Easter Sunday, the only Sunday the devil allowed his slaves to walk the 15 miles to the Black Baptist church on the edge of town, waiting for the sermon to start. Without thinking, she began singing a little tree tune her mother used to sing sorrowfully on nights when the work of slavery was particularly grueling, when she had been beaten for supposed insolence, or laziness, or failure. The dove has failed, oh what to do? Make her to suffer, or you'll fail too. Ness didn't know what she was singing, for Essie had never taught her what the words of the song meant. But in the pew in front of her, a woman turned and whispered something. "I'm sorry, I don't understand," Ness said. The words the woman spoke had been in her mother's tongue. "So you are an Ashanti, and you don't even know," the woman said. Her accent was still thick, like Essie's had been, gleaming with the lightness of the Gold Coast. She introduced herself as Aku, and she explained that she was from Ashantiland and had been kept in the castle just like Ness's mother had, before being shipped to the Caribbean and then to America. "I know the way back out," Aku said. The sermon was about to begin, and Ness knew she wouldn't have much time. Easter Sunday would not come again for another year, and by that time she or Aku or both could be sold, dead even. Theirs was the kind of life that did not guarantee living. They had to act fast. Aku talked softly, told Ness about how she had taken Akan people north to freedom many times, so many times that she had earned the tree nickname, Nyamienta, Hand of God, of help. Ness knew that no one had ever escaped the devil's plantation, but listening to this woman, who sounded like her mother had, who praised the God her mother had praised, Ness knew that she wanted her family to be the first. Joe was 1 year old when Ness began planning her family's freedom. The woman had assured her that she had taken children north before, babies who were still screaming and whining for their mother's tits. Joe would be no problem. Ness and Sam talked about it every night they were together. "You can't raise a baby in hell," Ness repeated over and over again, thinking about the way she'd been stolen from her own mother. Who knew how long she'd have with her perfect child before he forgot the sound of her voice, the details of her face, the way she had forgotten Essie's. And when Sam finally agreed, they sent word to Aku, telling her that they were ready, that they would wait for her signal, an old tree song, sung softly in the woods, as though carried by windswept leaves. And so they waited, Ness and Sam and Kojo, working longer and harder in the fields than any of the other slaves, so that even the devil began to smile at the mention of their names. They waited out fall, and then winter, listening for the sound that would tell them it was time, praying that they wouldn't be sold and separated before their chance came. They weren't, but Ness often wondered if it wouldn't have been better if they had been. The song came in the spring, so light Ness thought that perhaps she had imagined it. But soon Sam was grabbing Joe in one arm and Ness in the other, and the three of them were out beyond the Devil's Land for the first time that they could remember. That first night, they walked so long, so far, that the cracked soles of Ness's feet opened up. She bled on the leaves, and hoped for rain, so that the dogs that were surely coming wouldn't be able to catch her scent. When the sun came up, they climbed the trees.
Ness hadn't done it since childhood, but the skill came back to her quickly. She wrapped Joe around her back with cloth and reached for the highest branch. When he cried, she smothered him against her chest. Sometimes, after she had done this, he would get so still, she would worry, long for his cries. But they were all practicing stillness there. Stillness like the kind Essie used to talk about in her stories about the big boat. Stillness like death. Days passed this way, the four of them playing trees in the woods or grass in the fields, but soon Ness could feel a heat rising from the earth, and she knew, the way a person knew air or love just by feeling, that the devil was after them. "Would you take Kojo tonight?" Ness asked Aku, while Sam and the boy had wandered off in search of water to drink. "Just for tonight. My back can't take much more of him." Aku nodded, giving her a strange look, but Ness knew what she wanted, and she wouldn't change her mind. That morning the dogs came, their panting heavy and labored as their paws slapped against the tree where Ness hid. From afar there was a whistle, an old Dixie tune that lifted from the ground before the sound could be attached to a body. "I know you're here somewhere," the devil said, "and I'm glad to wait you out." In Broken Tree, Ness called to Aku, who was further up in the distance, holding baby Joe. "Don't come down, whatever you do," Ness said. The devil continued approaching, his hum low and patient. Ness knew he would wait there forever, and soon the baby would cry, need food. She looked over at the tree Sam was in, and hoped he would forgive her for all that she was about to bring upon them. And then she climbed down the tree. She was on the ground before she realized that Sam had done the same. "Where's the boy?" the devil asked, while his men tied the two of them up. "Dead," Ness said, and she hoped her eyes had that look in them. That look that mothers got sometimes when they came back from running, having killed their children to set them free. The devil raised one eyebrow and laughed a slow laugh. "It's a shame, really. I thought I might have had me some trustworthy niggers. Just goes to show." He marched Ness and Sam back to hell. Once they got there, all of the slaves were called out to the whipping post. He stripped them both bare, tied Sam so tight he couldn't even wiggle his fingers, and made him watch as Ness earned the stripes that would make her too ugly to work in a house ever again. By the end of it, Ness was on the ground, dust covering her sores. She could not lift her head, so the devil lifted it for her. He made her watch. He made them all watch. The rope come out, the tree branch bend, the head snap free from body. And so this day, while Ness waited to see what punishment Tom Allen had in store for her, she couldn't help but remember that day. Sam's head. Sam's head tilted to the left and swinging. Pinky carried water up to the porch where Tom Allen sat, waiting. When the little girl turned back around, her eyes caught Ness's, but Ness didn't hold her gaze for long. She just continued to pick cotton. She thought of the act of cotton picking as she had since the day she saw Sam's head, like a prayer. "With the bend," she said, "Lord, forgive me my sins." "With the pluck," she said, "deliver us from evil." And with the lift, she said, "and protect my son, wherever he may be." James. Outside, the small children were singing Ese Shame Mamu and dancing around the fire, their smooth, naked bellies glistening like little balls catching light. They were singing because word had arrived. The Ashantis had Governor Charles McCarthy's head. They were keeping it on a stick outside the Ashanti King's palace as a warning to the British. This is what happens to those who defy us. Eh, small children, do you not know that if the Ashantis defeat the British, they will come for us Fantis next? James asked. He lunged at one of the little girls and tickled her until all of the children were giggling and begging for mercy. He released the girl and then put on a somber face, continuing his lecture. You will be safe here in this village because my family is royal. Do not forget that. Yes, James, they said. Down the road, James's father was approaching with one of the white men from the castle. He motioned to James to follow them into the compound. Should the boy hear this, Quay? The white man asked, glancing quickly at James. He is a man, not a boy. He will take over my responsibilities here when I've finished. Whatever you say to me, you may also say to him. The white man nodded and looked at James carefully as he spoke. Your mother's father, Ose Bonsu, has died. The Ashantis are saying we killed their king to avenge Governor McCarthy's death. And did you? James asked, returning the man's stare with force, anger beginning to boil up in his veins. The white man looked away. James knew the British had been inciting tribal wars for years, knowing that whatever captives were taken from these wars would be sold to them for trade. His mother always said that the Gold Coast was like a pot of groundnut soup. Her people, the Ashantis, were the broth, and his father's people, the Fantis, were the groundnuts. And the many other nations that began at the edge of the Atlantic and moved up through the bushland into the north made up the meat and pepper and vegetables. This pot was already full to the brim before the white man came and added fire. Now it was all the Gold Coast people could do to keep from boiling over again and again and again. James wouldn't be surprised if the British had killed his grandfather as a way to raise the heat. Ever since his mother had been stolen and married to his father, his village had been swelteringly hot. Your mother wants to go to the funeral, Quay said. James unclenched the fist he hadn't realized he'd made. It's too dangerous, Quay, the white man said. Even Nana Ya's royal status might not protect you. They know your village has been allied to us for years. It's just too dangerous. James's father looked down, and suddenly James could hear his mother's voice in his ear again, telling him that his father was a weak man with no respect for the land he walked on. We will go, James said, and Quay looked up. Not attending the Ashanti King's funeral is a sin the ancestors would never forgive. Slowly, Quay nodded. He turned to the white man. It is the least we can do, he said. The white man shook hands with the two of them. And the next day, James, his mother, and his father headed north for Kumasi. His grandmother, Efia, would stay home with the younger children. James held the gun in his lap as they rode through the forest. The last time he'd held one was 5 years before, in 1819, for his 12th birthday. His father had taken him out into the woods to shoot at swaths of fabric he had tied to various trees in the distance. He told James that a man should learn to hold a gun the same way he held a woman, carefully, tenderly. Now, looking at his parents as they rode through the bush, James wondered if his father had ever held his mother that way, carefully or tenderly. If war had been the way of the world of the Gold Coast, it had also defined the world inside his compound. Nanaya wept as they rode inside the carriage.
"If it weren't for my son, would we even be going?" she asked.